Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the World Series of Politics podcast, where two heavy hitters in the political, legislative, and regulatory space take swings at the curveballs thrown at the gaming sector by legislators and regulators around the world for IGB. We've got Brendan Bussman and Grant Iden stepping up to the plate to discuss the hot topics in this space from across the world. Let's play ball on another episode of the World Series of Politics.
Welcome back to the World Series of Politics podcast. I'm your host, Brent Iden, along with not one, but two co-hosts today. We have got the kid himself. Robin is on with us, and we have just got a jam-packed show. Brendan, you're not going to believe this. This is our 50th, man.
Here, I know
we have
it's
been
50.
Doing this the big for 50 five-0. Times now.
Yes. And we especially wanted to have a certain guest on, and we thought long and hard about this, and we are graced with the presence of Mr. Frank Fahrenkopf to join us for that illustrious 50th episode. Well, Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Enjoy it.
Frank, it's great to have you on. You have, as I mentioned before we started this is fantastic. We are kicking off the National Conference of Legislators from Gaming States in Louisville this week, today, actually. So we are recording from Louisville, except for obviously you and Robin, who are not, but Brendan and I are here. And look, we've got a lot to talk about in the gaming world. We're going to talk a little bit of politics. I know that many of our listeners know your background, but of course, you were the chairman of the RNC throughout the 80s. You went on to the American Gaming Association. Great background in legal work. And so we've got a lot of wonderful questions for you. So can't thank you enough. And I'm going to jump right in, if you don't mind. And we're going to start with, you know, obviously in D.C., big news out of D.C., right prior to the 4th, on the 4th of July, President Trump signs the One Big Beautiful Act. There was some fallout on the gaming side for gamblers, potentially, on some tax deductions that they may no longer be able to get. And, you know, what are your thoughts on that, both from a political perspective as to how the OBBA came into place, and then your thoughts on the gaming aspect?
Well, let me put it this way. With regard to the bill they've just signed, and I know that my good friend Bill Miller, who took my place after I retired from the American Gaming Association, has taken some hits that maybe he didn't fight hard enough. I know Bill very, very well. I think he's doing a great job, the American Gaming Association. I'll tell you, the great, big, beautiful bill was very hard to follow and make sure you understand all the elements that are in it. And I sure the hell don't at this point in time. And I'll leave that to Bill to represent the gaming industry, which I did for many, many years. But it's very interesting that this comes up in this way, because I was practicing law in Washington after I'd retired from being chairman of the party for President Reagan. I went with a law firm, Hogan and Hartson, a big firm in Washington, D.C. And one of my best friends was a fellow by the name of Raymond Avancino, known as Skip Avancino. He was at that time the president of Hilton Hotels. And Hilton was holding a board meeting in Washington, D.C., and he dropped by to see me. And I explained to him that at that time, there was a lot of noise on the Hill about creating the Clinton administration going forward, Hillary to be financing her plans for health care by raising the money by taxing the industry. And I said, you know, what's so weird is that every sort of industry has their own lobbying shop, people who represent them, whether they're in agriculture and everything else. And here's the gaming industry who has no one. And I suggest that you really talk to other people in the industry. You might want to think about getting some representation, particularly with what the heat is now about taxing the industry. He went back and talked to Baron Hilton, and Baron got all the CEOs together at that time in Las Vegas and got them to agree that they were going to create something that would represent the industry. I was at that time really not interested in being the man who was going to do it, but I was going to help them find someone. I found a headhunter firm for them. They talked to them. It was Steve Wynn and Avancino, the Hilton people. Everyone was involved. Terry Lanny at that time. Those are the names that are back in the 80s and 90s were the power in the industry. And they interviewed many, many people and couldn't really come up with somebody that they felt comfortable with. And then they came to me and said, look, why don't you do it for 1 year since you're a Nevadan? You've appeared before the Nevada Gaming Control Board and you know the industry. You know, you know where the bodies are buried. And I said, all right, I'll do it for 1 year and I'll represent the industry. Well, wow. I was there for, I think, maybe 18 years I was there. And we were fortunate enough to beat back the plans to tax the industry, many more than there, just as regular industries who pay normal taxes. But then immediately we're hit with an organization that was designed to do away with gambling in the United States of America to make it illegal. It was run by the Methodist Church. They organized. They were very strong in preparing for their work. A committee was created, a national commission to study the industry. And I followed it all over the United States, peered, testified, and so forth. And we were fortunate to come out of that really with some solid things for the gaming industry, casino industry, because we had created something that I came up with called the Institute for Problem Gambling, the National Association for Problem Gambling. We brought in people, the experts, to do it. And I tell you, it was a hard sell at the beginning. I had to hold up a picture of all the presidents of the tobacco companies who were testifying on the Hill, raising their right hand to tell the truth, and were saying that cigarettes was that you couldn't get attached to them. They weren't addictive in any way, shape, or form. And I fundamentally said, do you guys want to be sitting there someday talking about gambling? Because we know there are some people who can't gamble responsibly. Well, we were fortunate enough to beat that back, do well. And I was there for a long, long time. But we were able to dodge any effects or attempts to unfairly, in our view, tax the industry. But now I think Bill Miller is doing a good job. His team is doing a good job. And we'll see where this thing comes out. I don't understand all the ins and outs of the question that you asked with regard to what's in that bill.
No, that's fair. That's fair. That's great. That's great. Brendan?
I was going to say, Frank, I don't know if the people that voted on it know what's necessarily in the bill either. And I say that after they spent 16 hours reading it in the Senate, then went through all the amendments. And as it relates specifically to the gaming issue, you know, you're seeing more and more things as they come out going, well, I didn't know that was in there. I don't know how it got in. I don't know how this. So, you know, it's one of those that we got to figure out where all the bodies are actually buried first. But, you know, we've got Congresswoman Titus, who's my congresswoman, that introduced the Fair Bet Act and some of those things. But, you know, you've talked about your tenure and sort of how the industry came to be and, lobbying for the AGA. During that time, what was, you know, your, I would say, crowning achievement along the way to say, hey, not only did I launch this thing, but you talked about the tax, you talked about, you know, the RG mechanisms, but was there anything else in that you really were like, hey, I'm really proud that as an industry, we came together and did X?
Yeah, it really has to do with responsible gaming. We organized that organization. I met a professor at Harvard who was an expert in the field of addiction, particularly among young people. And so I met with him. And what we did is we financed an institute that he would do the research. There'd be a Chinese wall between it and the industry because there was some criticism that went against the tobacco industry and the alcohol industry that they were putting something like that together, but they were influencing what the result was going to be. But that is now the world famous association studying responsible gaming, what to do with people who are addicted to gambling and how to avoid having them. And I'm most proud of that. That has not only grown, it's a small thing that we created way back when, and it's now the premier institution with regard to responsible gaming in the world.
And Frank, just to follow up on that, you mentioned earlier that this kind of institution came out of a period of sustained pressure on the industry from its kind of opponents. And it's something that, you know, we've seen it in the UK, we've seen it in multiple countries, but we're definitely seeing it in the US. So with the industry and the way it's evolved today, you know, with sports betting, with iCasino, like, do you feel that sort of RG kind of program needs to evolve further? And if so, like, how do you see that evolution kind of happening for the digital age?
You know, when you talk about the history there, I testified before Parliament.
Wow.
I'm trying to remember who the Prime Minister was who wanted to put together some of the big institutions, gambling and things, in three different places in England. I can't remember.
It was Blair.
And Tony had me, I went to 10 Downing Street and I warned them. I said, first of all, you got to remember there are two institutions that hate gambling. One is religion and the other is newspapers. And I said, you better be prepared for what you're going to be hit with. And going forward, I had the same thing in Australia. I went down there and had to do the same thing with Australia. But the net result was, you know, that you didn't get what Tony Blair originally wanted to have. Now, certainly what's going on now, it was something that I was really concerned about just before I left the AGA, was offshore gambling online. And it was unregulated, uncontrolled, untaxed. And I was in favor of legalizing it in the states where you could at least have regulation and taxation and so forth. One of the people who I could never convince was Sheldon Adelson. Sheldon was a dear friend, but Sheldon kept telling me, Frank, I have two sons and I'm just afraid they're going to get addicted to it. And I said, Sheldon, they could do it right now because there's 2,000 offshore websites they can get on right now that are unregulated. There's no control. But Sheldon, I loved him. He was a wonderful man, wonderful for the industry. We miss him. But I could never convince him that it was important to get regulation involved in it. And now we get to the point where the sports gaming has just gone crazy. You know, I'm on the board of Caesars, so I speak from someone who was involved in the industry. And it is growing. It's something else. I was very afraid early on that we'd have more instances where sports people would be involved in fixing games or shaving points or something else. We had a couple of cases way back when. What was it in Arizona when I think it was Arizona State got caught three players and were thrown out. John McCain was very upset about what was happening there. But it has not been as bad as I thought it would be. But I'm worried about where we're going right now. And I'm not sure there's enough out there telling people who can get addicted to gambling online with all that's going on now in sports particularly and where we're going. And I think that may be a place where Bill Miller and the AGA are going to have to fight some battles in the future with regard to what regulation might be there, at least to stop the offshore people.
No, you're right, Frank. And our friends at the AGA and Bill have done a great job of working on that. But as you say, there's a lot more to do. They're doing great work, but man, there's just so many every day that are popping up. It's tough. You know, it's a tough, tall order. Well, let me ask you, pivoting a little bit,
yes.
You know, what's the biggest change you've seen in the industry from the time, you know, you first got involved in this to when you walk into a casino today, when you walk into Caesars and you go on the floor and you say, man, this didn't used to be like that or that. What's the big thing that sort of blows your mind? And you're like, man, I never saw that thing coming, the slots or the table game. You know, what is it? Any thoughts on that?
Well, the slots are probably the biggest change.
they certainly are.
You know, I grew up in Reno, Nevada, and I can remember when people weren't looking, we would sneak into one of the casinos and put nickels in. You could put, if you got three chairs, you've got four nickels back. I mean, now the industry that manufactures slot machines. And I just left the board of BMM. BMM is an international company. It's an American company, but came out of Australia. And before any casino in the world that something is electric, plugged in, you have to have independent testing to make sure that the machine is safe. And so for the last 10 years, I was on the board of BMM, which is a test lab. And so that's a big difference from the little slots that they used to have when I was growing up in Reno, Nevada. I mean, some of them are incredible. We were recently at a new casino that we at Caesars had opened in Southern Virginia. And I walked around there. And as I was walking around, some of these machines, I mean, it's incredible compared to what they used to be. So that's the biggest change. If you go into Pitt, you know, the Pitt's pretty much the same. You're going to have I don't see it there, other than, as you know, with some machines, now you've got, it looks like you're dealing with a dealer. You know, there's a beautiful woman there and you're playing poker with her, but she's not really there. That's before AI. There are a lot of different changes that have taken place.
And I'm also, like you mentioned, testifying UK Parliament and the Australian Parliament, sitting in, you know, a company with Australian heritage, which kind of speaks to the nature of the industry becoming a lot more kind of international. I mean, how important do you feel that, like, on the association level, that kind of internationalization and kind of these kind of connections between all these different groups? For example, last year, you know, Bill Miller at the AGA signed the agreement between the Betting and Gaming Council in the UK and the European Casino Association. So do you feel that as the industry becomes more international, these kind of ties are between different countries and different associations are becoming more important?
Let me back up for a minute. When we created the AGA, it was just the major casino, primarily in Nevada and New Jersey, and the manufacturers. We slowly started. We started with IGT and then others joined. But the Indians came along. And the question was whether or not we should include Native American gaming as members of the overwhelming decision of the board was no. And the reason that we were saying no was because we were concerned that the regulation of Native American gaming would not be as stiff and as strict as there was for the regular industry, and therefore it could cause problems to everything. But I must say, that was a worry that we shouldn't have made. Native American gaming has been done a great job on regulation. There have been very few cases where there's been something that we should have been afraid of. And they are now members of the American Gaming Association. If I had it to do over again, I might have pushed a little harder on my board to at least pick some of them to join. Now, when you talk about other associations, I mean, the first association we really started to deal with was Canadians, and they've got a good organization, good regulation. So I think as other things pop up around the world, it's going to depend on how the board of directors feels as to whether or not it's something they should be, joining. But hopefully that happens, because I think the more that they're involved, the better it's going to be.
I'm going to close out with my last question I have for you, Frank. And I know I told you before we started, I asked you a really tough question about your golf game.
Yes.
But I'm going to pivot a little bit here. Are we ever going to see a presidential debate commission host debates again in 2028?
Well, I think we will. We're still alive. It was what happened. Fundamentally, we had already picked the three universities who were going to do the presidential and the one vice presidential. Everything was done the way it was done in the past. In order to be considered as participant, you had to be on enough ballots in states that you conceivably could get to 270 electoral votes. And you had to be about 15% in the ballots of polls. What happened was, and I think with more and more books coming out, they realized that there was no way in hell that Joe Biden, even though Joe had done four debates with us, two presidential and two vice presidential, and he knew how we did it and operated, they knew he could not stand there for 90 minutes without a break and with six topics being really gone deep on. And so they came up with this idea that they were going to not, they could do it with us. They went to CNN, who was in some financial difficulties, and said, if you do it soon at CNN with us, we'll let you do breaks and you can sell advertising on the middle of these breaks. CNN signed on, and they made sure that what was going to happen is that rather than having to talk about an issue, particular issue, for 15 minutes with your opponent, it would be 1 minute that Joe Biden would have to make his position. Trump would have had a minute, and then it would have been another minute for Joe, and then they would move on to another subject. They took him up to outside of Washington and trained him and thought he could handle it, and he couldn't handle it, and it went down. And I think it was an embarrassment. I felt sorry for, I've known Joe Biden for 40 years. I've known Donald for 40 years. Different personalities, I might add.
Definitely.
It was sort of a sad night, actually, when you saw what happened. So, but we're still there. We're working now in 40 nations around the world in really some very wonderful people, non-public involvement, who are trying to get debates on in their countries. They've put their lives at risk because in some of these countries, there's never been different parties that would participate in a democratic approach. So we're working internationally still. And we intend to be back, in 28, and we'll make up. But it depends who the candidates are. Donald was making a lot of noise. He wasn't going to do it, but he finally said he was going to do it. He said, I'm going to do Fahrenkopf's debate commission, even though it is corrupt. That's the nicest thing that Donald said. So we're hoping when 28 comes that the parties, which we don't deal with, that was another thing. The Republican National Committee announced it was withdrawing from the commission. Well, I don't know how you withdraw from something you never belong to. We don't deal with the parties. We just deal with those candidates who meet the Constitution and other requirements. So we will be there, and we'll see what happens. And hopefully we can talk to whoever the nominees are going to be and get them to come back, because we think it's important for the American people to find out exactly where the candidates stand on the issues. And one other thing I've learned, having done 33 of these now, starting in 1988, 33 debates. The American people also want to watch the candidates. They want to like their president. They want to see how they handle things, well, how they handle pressure and so forth. And so that's a very important thing that we haven't seen. Hopefully we get back to it in 28.
I hope you do. I'm going to make a plug that you put one back in Nebraska, because you had a vice presidential one there years and years ago, and it was great to have that there.
Well, one of the first members of my commission was my close friend Kay Orr, who was the governor. Kay was one of the first members of the Commission on Presidential Debates.
Yep, she was great. Still is.
Yep.
Still is. Even though she disagrees on our issue here.
Frank, this has been absolutely fantastic. We can't thank you enough. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, the great Frank Barrenkoff, lobbyist, you know, AGA president, Caesars board member. I mean, you name it, lawyer, a true mentor, legend in the industry. Couldn't think of a better way to cap off our 50th episode. So, Frank, we thank you so much for being
thank
here.
Thank you so much. Thanks
this
for having me.
This has been another episode of the World Series of Politics Podcast.
You got it. Thanks
thank
a lot.
You guys.
Thank
okay,
you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the World Series of Politics Podcast with Brendan Bussman and Brent Eichen. We'll be back at the starting line very soon. This has been an IGB production. For the latest news, views, analysis, and data on the global gaming industry, head to igamingbusiness.com.